ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In 2007, four people vanished. It was dubbed a death cult. But after months of investigation, I don't think it's that simple. I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nanup 4, a story of people drawn into a 20-year saga they didn't ask for, who have spent decades trying to reconcile the choices they made that led them here.
The family lived a bizarre alternative lifestyle.
Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Monet or a Madonna album, death metal or a dot painting, whatever art you're into, you know it has the ability to transport you to a different time and place. Research is showing it could even save your life, but how exactly? And if it does, what should that mean for how we support the arts? That is in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, we keep being told we need to be AI literate, and fine, that sounds like a reasonable goal, but is a concept like literacy enough to cover something as vast and fast-moving as AI? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, did you go to uni? When I say go to uni, I mean physically attend on campus. I'd want to know what it was like. Were your lecture halls full of people taking notes or doodling? Did you watch bands in the uni bar and hang out on the lawn between classes? Maybe you took part in some dubious O-week traditions? University has always been about so much more than just the coursework. But as students return to their studies this week, campus is not the hive of social activity that it once was. Gone are the wild, fresher shenanigans. Uni bars are few and far between. Most lectures are pre-recorded and available online. Campus culture has changed dramatically. But is that a problem? How important is the social side of uni life, not just for well-being, but for learning, and what happens when it's gone? I want to hear about your uni days this morning. Was the social side just as important as the academic for you? Where did you hang out? How did you spend your time? What lessons did you learn beyond the lecture theatre? Maybe you've actually returned to study and you're noticing a difference on campus this time around. I'd especially love to hear from you, but give me a call, 1300 225 576, and we'll talk about uni life. With me to chat about it is Dan Woodman. He spends a lot of time on campus. He is a sociologist at the University of Melbourne and a regular here on Life Matters. And also with me is Andrew J. Martin, Professor of Educational Psychology at the University of New South Wales. Welcome to you both. Dan, I'm going to start with you. I want to know what your uni days were like.
And I think I want to tell you about some of them. O-week and that first week of university for me, it was life-changing, really. I'd moved into state to study, and I'd moved to Melbourne, where I am now. And the people I met during those first couple of weeks really shaped my 20s. So friends who are still friends to these days, people I traveled with, some people I dated in my early 20s, they were all basically people I met in this very short period of my life as I started university.
It's funny, as you're saying that, I'm like thinking of my uni friends, and at least half of the people I still stay in touch with I met in O-week. You're absolutely right. Andrew, you were an undergrad in the 80s. What was your uni experience like?
Yes, an undergrad in the 80s, and I guess I was the classic archetypal. I was an arts student in the 80s at a major urban campus in Sydney. So there were long days on campus. There were often, sometimes long breaks between classes, and so that afforded a fair bit of incidental learning, sometimes at the bar, that I note now has much more restricted hours these days. And I guess it was a one-stop shop. There were no mobile phones. So if you wanted to know anything of what was going on socially, you had to show up to campus. It was such a novel, such unfamiliar territory coming from a suburban life in a fairly conservative, boys' school. I think my head was spinning for the first year, and I don't think my marks looked in any way credible until about second year.
Andrew, you obviously did all right. You're a professor now, as is Dan. Dan, you're at the University of Melbourne, which is a pretty, it's got a very long history. What's the campus vibe this week?
So we had our O week last week and now we're into classes. And it is, it's really my favourite time of year because it is pretty vibrant on campus. But what is different is that it's probably a little bit more controlled. So O week when I was a student would start in the morning, usually the late morning, but in the morning and then go right into the night and was very alcohol focused and even the first couple of weeks. That's less so now. There's still lots of activities, but what's clear as well is that the campus buzz doesn't last so long. So after a few weeks into semester, people have discovered that a lot of the activity can now be undertaken asynchronously, so whenever you want and online as well.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Professor Dan Woodman, sociologist from the University of Melbourne, and Professor Andrew Martin, who is an educational psychologist at the University of New South Wales. Don't let their titles fool you. They were cool young things one time. We're talking about early uni days and how campus life is different these days to the way it was when Dan, Andrew and myself, and maybe you, went to uni back in the day. Nicole has called in. Nicole, tell me about what you're seeing between your uni life and your kids' experience.
Yeah, well, I was a bit of a babe in the woods and I went to university when I was about 17. Met a heap of people. I went to University of Sydney and then later on to New South Wales. Had a great campus life. Used to go and see bands, like I went and saw Dragon at the Footbridge Theatre. I saw Cold Chisel at the Roundhouse. I'll never forget Jimmy Barnes smashing his guitars and so forth. My daughter has done everything online virtually, right? She had 1 year a bit of on campus, but a lot of it was obviously all online. There hasn't been the motivation. There hasn't been the friendship. My young bloke, he actually lived on campus at New South Wales Uni for a couple of years. He had a social group there, but still a lot of online, and then COVID hit, everything went online definitely. So I remember my uni years with wonderful, wonderful memories, okay? And it was initiation for me, definitely. And I remember orientation day going, thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, I've never seen a world like this before. And, yeah, it was a great experience. But, yeah, I think the young ones, everything's online, online.
That's such a good point, Nicole. Thank you so much for the call. Rebecca's also called in. Rebecca, you're an academic. Talk to me about that side of things.
Yeah, I'm a researcher and teacher, and I went into higher education because, like Nicole, I had an amazing time at uni. I was also at Sydney Uni. And so everyone I know in my career, I've worked at a bunch of unis, is passionate about teaching. They want students to have a great experience. But what's happening at the moment is students just aren't turning up. So we talk a lot about the online teaching move, and there's lots of critiques for that, and there should be. But part of it is that students don't come to class. So you're standing at a lecture theatre and it's empty, or you're on campus and it's really quiet, or you run an event and no one comes. This isn't a critique of students. There's lots of reasons they don't come. I also worked 3 jobs when I was an undergrad in the year 2000 and, you know, lived out of home. And so I understand, like, it's even harder for students now, and they're post-COVID, so there's lots going on. But if students don't turn up, we can't keep running things. So it's a really, there's a lot of tension in what's happening on campuses at the moment for everyone involved. But I do notice that in a lot of these discussions, academics and their experiences of campus life and student life are left out. Like, we're the ones facilitating it and working really hard. And when I say students aren't turning up, I mean, I'm talking about excellent teachers.
No, Rebecca, that's such a good point. It's demoralising, I think, if you're trying to put on something that's world class and you feel like you're talking to an empty room. Andrew, how much of your teaching are you doing online these days? Are you a teacher?
So I'm a research professor. So my students are postgrads, and a lot of that is online. In some ways, that suits them because they're at a stage in life where where, you know, life's a little more multifaceted and they've got other responsibilities. But certainly, certainly with the undergrad experience, I agree with Dan. It's just, it's been wonderful seeing so many students on campus, just this energy and dynamism and vibrance. The reality is in 4 to 6 weeks' time, you'll start seeing that slip away. And students will be increasingly online and so on. And so, there is, and I agree with the previous caller, that is a distinct shift. And the fact they do show up for the first handful of weeks suggests that there's a capacity to do so. And so we, you know, as universities, how can we look to maintain that through a term and a semester, I think is important.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, where you are blowing up my phone. Cassandra, your daughter's in year 12. She's looking at unis. Is she excited for uni life?
Look, she really isn't, and I feel sad for her. I had, like, the absolute privilege of being at Melbourne Uni starting in 1984, pre-HECS, and my experience was amazing. Going from, you know, high school to uni was a life changer. And it just seems that the experience that I got is not what my daughter will ever experience. You know, it's just, it seems quite, tough for them. That it seems isolating and they're worried about HECS, of course.
Cassandra, thanks so much for the call. Jean, you've also called in. You've been a part-time and a full-time student. What was the difference you saw in those two modes?
Yeah, there's definitely a distinct difference between the experience. You know, the full-time student being on campus almost every day of the week, the social connections, and particularly the interaction with the lecturers and the tutors. I think that's what's lost now with the educational approach of unis. There's just too much asynchronous learning. There's not enough actual contact with tutors and lecturers, which is where the real learning and insight can happen and the connection. And I think the rise of AI now, where the AI can log in and do your assignments for you and digest all the content, I think what this will mean is that there's going to be a rise at unis again of having students on campus and interacting with the lecturers and the tutors, which is just gone. Whereas in the 90s at Melbourne Uni when I was there, full-time student, it was great. Then I was a part-time student and it was dreadful. It was just less than half the experience.
That's a really interesting prediction, Jean. I'm looking forward to thinking back to this comment in a couple of years' time if we do see a push towards people back on campus again. On Life Matters, I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Professor Dan Woodman from the University of Melbourne and Professor Andrew Martin from UNSW talking about uni life these days. I'd love to know what your uni days were like, what you got out of your campus life that wasn't maybe taught in a classroom. Chris says, 1970s at La Trobe University is where I developed a political consciousness. I was an ignorant country kid, and the meetings and protests and classes was where I started to think about where my values lie. Jane went to ANU in 1978. It was a diplomatic way of leaving home, Melbourne. Friends I met at Bruce Hall in my first weeks of life there remain my closest friends. I learnt so much more about life after 13 years of an all-girls school. Uni was such a pivotal part of my development. Dan, I'm getting this sense of people really coming into their adult selves on campus, but not necessarily in the classroom.
Yeah, that's right. We've heard a few callers now talk about their world getting bigger, you know, when they got to university, new perspectives. And I guess maybe today's students are missing out on that. They can probably get it somewhere else, and probably schools are, high schools are a little bit more open now to being who you are, so you don't have to get to university before you can embrace your true self or work out who that is. But we did have this institutional mechanism that really did expand people's worlds in a way that online connection might give you, but doing it face-to-face, meeting people from all different backgrounds and of all different beliefs and talking to them in the same cafe or the same classroom is hard to replicate. And it is, I think it's maybe something to be concerned about, that we've lost this institutionalized way of doing that.
I'm interested, Andrew, to sort of talk about the academic side of things. I know we're focusing a lot on the campus life, but what does the campus life do for a student's academic performance?
Yeah, so if we look at how students learn, I mean, the aim of learning is to be able to, at the end of it, you've stored something away in long-term memory and you can retrieve it, you know, when you need to at a later point. That's what learning is. And, you know, an in-person, real-time lecture, you know, enables you to do that. It's typically linear. The lecturer is presenting one thing at a time. You're there with fewer distractions than if you're online. Online, there are many screens. There's a chat bar. You're probably, you know, on, you know, surfing that or doing something as well. Now, of course, you can do that in the lecture theatre as well, but it's harder. And so all of that means that you know, you're pretty much on track and on target, and you optimize your capacity to basically process the information that is being presented to you because you've dedicated that space and time to do that. Online makes that harder. There are a lot of distractions, it jams what we call working memory, and so it does affect learning. And so if you're going to be learning online, you need an enormous amount of self-discipline and self-regulation to be focused just on that, and that's very difficult to do. So as far as learning goes, there are upsides for this more classic approach. That said, online does allow you to go over the lecture again to, you know, when you need to revise. But even that being the case, we're finding students play lectures at two or three times the speed. and so again, that limits how much you can remember. So there are distinct learning implications for the decision to be in person, online, or hybrid.
You're calling me with your university experiences this morning here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm especially interested to know about the social side of your uni experience. Scott, you want to shout out the social and support groups at unis.
Yeah, g'day Tegan, Dan and Andrew. I'm in Tasmania and I was at UTAS from 69 to 74 and did medicine, which was a pretty full-time course. But look, if we just sort of narrowly define the social experience of sex, drugs and rock and roll, it leaves a lot of other stuff out as well. And being on campus and being with various other people, I was a member of the Students for a Democratic Society, for example. I was called up, the Vietnam War was on, I was called up and registered as a conscientious objector. There was a support group for us conscientious objectors as well. We had a lot of demonstrations in the streets and around the city and so on. And I guess I learned a lot of socio-political skills as well as a bit of medicine. And those socio-political skills have been really useful, our survival skills for me in my subsequent life.
Scott, that is a fantastic story. I hope you did, if you are a practicing doctor, I hope you did pick up a bit of medicine along the way through there too. Luke, you're considering going back to uni. How much are you thinking about what the modern university experience is going to be like for you?
Well, it's a little saddened to hear that so much of it's gone online because in my experience, uni was one of the best parts of my life. And just as a quick story, I went in to do commerce and really wasn't enjoying the social side of it. And then I ended up picking up an elective in theatre at Curtin. And it was just amazing. I had a fantastic time and I still have friends from back then.
Luke, me too. I did a business degree, didn't get on with anyone, did one drama subject and found my tribe. We should be friends. Thanks for the call, Luke. So, Dan, if we're looking at what unis maybe could do, if a university is listening to this chat, what kind of tweaks could they make to keep the accessibility of online but regain that campus vibrancy?
It's a tough one because a lot of the changes that have come about are about accessibility, but they're also about cost. And people are working very, very hard to make asynchronous online learning fun and socially connecting and inspiring. But it seems to be pretty hard and there doesn't look to be a lot of extra money coming into the system. One thing I will say is that in making it accessible so people who are working can maybe study. We've also set up a world where employers also know that you don't necessarily need to go to class. Mm. So a world where the rest of the world knows that it's flexible and you can build your university around your employment, or your university around your life is great on the one hand, but it means that the university experiences can disappear. So there is a case, I think, for making it compulsory to turn up sometimes. There can be a case for that, because I think we're heading towards a situation where we might have greater inequalities in the university experience, because some people, you know, particularly living on colleges on some of those Group of Eight universities, still get something like that old experience, and then others are barely touching their campus their entire study period and are missing out on that time face to face with a cohort. So I think universities have to always work within their means, but there is a case for finding not just new bands or new activities, but maybe ways to say that, you know, university at these particular times is part of your life, and we would like to see you on campus for these weeks across your degree.
Andrew, briefly, is there a way that students can make their own luck? Like, how can you engineer some of this for yourself if that's what you want to get out of uni?
Look, I think part of it comes down to, and again, I agree with what Dan's saying. I think on the supply side, there needs to be a sort of a mix of requirement and incentives. As I indicated, you know, many students, many more students show up in the first, you know, 1 to 4 to 6 weeks than in the later weeks. So how can we sustain that? I think if students wanting to bake that into their own lives a little bit, I think it takes a little bit of planning on their part. So looking ahead. Life is very complex and multifaceted and piecemeal now. And so the old days will not come back. There needs to be flexibility, but how can students plan and bake some of the on-campus experience in? I think moving a little bit out of your comfort zone, that's what being on campus and meeting so many different people, not sitting in an echo chamber that you can online. And so I think that little bit of discomfort, and also looking very much optimistically at how you can shape that, your identity over these sort of late teens to early 20s years, is so critical for identity development, and be a little, lift your gaze and be a little ambitious and aspirational for who you are as a person and who you can be. I think those things could give a little bit more incentive to show up.
Dan, Andrew, thank you both so much for joining me this morning. Dan Woodman is a sociologist from the University of Melbourne, and Andrew J. Martin is a professor of educational psychology at the University of New South Wales. And thank you for sharing your stories. Kaz has texted saying, "My kids are at Melbourne Uni. They've made great mates living nearby, but not in all classes until this summer. My daughter did a summer intensive subject, 2 weeks of full-time classes in person with a cohort of about 40. Like the old days. It's a feminist third year subject and she met a tribe. They are loving their new peer group and are catching up weekly for dinners and are now studying together. If you're there in person, you can make friends." We'll stick around here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, the art that changed, or maybe even saved, your life. Where is this work of art taking you right now? For me, this soundscape is taking me somewhere very calm. I'm on a hike. I'm walking by a river of snowmelt. I'm fully transported just from listening to some noise. Art, whether it's in sound or hanging on a wall or performed to an audience, it's a force that can change our perspectives and it can motivate us to act. But can it save your life? It sounds like hyperbola, but you're about to meet a scientist who thinks it can, as well as the artist behind the soundscape you just heard, which might be as effective as medicine. I want to hear about how art has saved your life. Maybe it's a personal practice of making art. Maybe it's something that you found in the moment you needed it. Tell me about the art that saved your life. because with me is Daisy Fancourt, a professor of psychobiology and epidemiology at University College London and the director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Centre on Arts and Health. Her latest book is called Art Cure: The Science of How the Arts Saves Lives. Daisy, it is a big claim. You're a scientist. What's your evidence?
Well, this is a really important question because saving lives can mean different things to different people. For some people, it's about finding a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives, and the arts are very powerful ways of doing that. For other people, as I describe in my book, arts engagement can be the difference between life and death through helping with issues like severe mental illness, even helping people who've been contemplating taking their own lives. There are also examples of the arts being used in experiences like the Ebola epidemic, where arts was actually used to help spread important messages around how the virus was communicated, which did indeed save lives. And in fact, people who engage more in the arts actually do have longer lifespans, something that's been shown repeatedly in scientific studies now.
Wow, that's really interesting. I've put my health reporter hat on and I'm thinking what the confounders could be there. Like, if someone's engaging in the arts and they're more likely to live longer, is that perhaps a function of the fact that people with more resources maybe have more time to spend with the arts, or is it something about the arts specifically?
This is a really critical question. And actually, it's been over a dozen studies now that have used these longitudinal data sets to look at this relationship. And you're right that some of the association is explained by things like demographics, wealth, other aspects of lifestyle or other behaviors. But actually, all of these studies have consistently shown that the association remains even when we've accounted for those factors. And in fact, the emerging biological research is suggesting this could, in fact, be due to arts engagement affecting processes like the expression of our genes, proteins in our body, and even biological rates of aging as we get older.
Wow. So how is this actually happening?
Well, when we engage in the arts, we know it affects lots of different biological processes. It releases dopamine in the brain, which is a neurotransmitter involved in happiness. It affects biological stress response systems, affecting our heart rate, our blood pressure, stress hormones. It even leads to reductions in levels of inflammation within our immune system. So we're essentially seeing this multi-system cascade of biological processes that all influence so many aspects of our mental and physical health.
So you wrote a whole chapter in this book about the arts easing stress and pain. Can you tell me about how you came to meet Brian Eno in a hospital ward?
So when I used to work in the National Health Service in the UK, Brian Eno actually came to help us with a problem that we were facing, which was that so many patients in hospital, adults and children, were getting really anxious prior to surgeries. And this is an important issue because not only is that something that's not pleasant for a person, but it also increases the number of drugs that people need. It increases the risk of side effects. But Brian Eno came in because he'd actually had experiences of being in hospital himself after a traffic accident. And he'd seen how calming music really helped him in that scenario. So he developed new ambient music and also this beautiful digital artwork that we could play to patients whilst they were waiting for surgeries. And we found it had really profound effects on their biological stress response systems.
Well, speaking of the power of sound in the arts, also with me here is Professor Philip Simatsis. Philip is a sound artist and curator who has been awarded the Australian Antarctic Arts Fellowship 3 times in its history. Philip, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Tegan. And hey, Daisy, that's fantastic.
So listening to soundscapes as being used as a pain relief, what do you make of that as a sound artist?
I've also done some work in emergency settings at St. Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne as part of an ARC linkage, trying to measure the impact of music on, patients in the ED who are kind of awaiting some form of assessment or treatment. For that very reason, to kind of find a way of reducing some of the anxiety and also some of the boredom that patients experienced at that time. This was a time before streaming services, which are so ubiquitous now, were introduced. So we composed a series of compositions to test on patients. And I guess I'm very familiar with Brian Eno's music and the ambient genre. that he pioneered, what we found is that musical taste becomes a big part of the experience. So someone's ambient music is another person's noise. So we tried a whole range of different genres and styles of music, from improvisation, soundscape, electroacoustic music, as well as kind of more sedate kind of textural music as well. It's extremely effective.
How do you then know what to prescribe to which patient?
I was kind of done it in a trial setting. So the head of the ED helped us with that. So different patients would receive different types of music. And we'll just try and measure, I'd say it's just a kind of a general study to see what the reactions were. And we're really taken with how people responded, essentially, with the trial that we did of about 150 patients over 6 to 12 months or thereabouts. So I found that potentially or possibly soundscape was the strongest kind of oral experience that patients responded to most favourably, rather than music per se, because they could ascribe their own associations, dreams, interpretations to the sound of the ocean or wind or bird call, whatever it may have been.
So, as I said, you've been to Antarctica three times with the Australian Antarctic Arts Fellowship. Here is, I know you know what this sounds like, but other people don't yet. So let's listen to a little bit of one of your soundscapes. What are we listening to here, Philip?
Sorry, we're listening to the sound of the RSB Aurora Australis in 2010 crossing the Southern Ocean, and the ship stabilizers, which are kind of a respiratory system, inhaling and exhaling as it tries to steady the ship while the ocean kind of buffets it with huge waves. And it's just a hit, just before we hit the ice, and we crash through the ice after about a week or so of this kind of heaving and sighing.
What were you trying to capture when you were down there doing the work you were doing?
I'm really interested in what people do in extreme environments, essentially, why they're there, how they adapt, the systems and protocols that sustain social cohesion, enable people to do the things that they need to do. So I can apply that anywhere in the world. It's just Antarctica was probably the most remote and unknown part of the world in regards to that. We've seen lots of natural history documentation, or documentaries, I should say, news media reporting, stories and movies about Ice Station Zebra comes to mind, about the ice. But I really want to know how people adapted to those extremities, and through sound to convey those observations and stories through soundscape composition and sound art more generally.
I'm Tegan Taylor. This is ABC Radio National. You're listening to Life Matters. I'm with Daisy Fancourt, who's a professor of psychobiology and epidemiology at the University College London, and Professor Philip Samartsis, who's a sound artist, researcher, and a curator with RMIT. He's a three-time Australian Antarctic Arts Fellow. And we're talking about this idea that art can save lives. It's the part of the title of Daisy's book. Greg says, writing poetry after suffering a major depression helped me in getting better. It's quite dark, but helped me express feelings that were otherwise difficult to articulate. Paula Inam says, I studied visual arts at university in the 80s. I've always enjoyed visual and performing arts. In my retirement, I've had time to take lessons in painting, and now I paint every day. It keeps me relaxed and it gives me a spark when my work sells. And Gina from Nipaluna Hobart points out that books are art. Books are free through our magnificent public libraries. There are so many stories of people having their lives transformed by reading a poem or a novel that makes them feel heard. Books save lives every day. Well, Daisy, I'd like to come to this idea that engaging with art can expand our horizons. If we take that further, is there evidence to suggest that arty people are smarter?
This is a really interesting point because actually it's one of the myths that I bust in my new book, Art Cure, is the idea that actually engaging in arts can make you smarter per se. It's something that was discussed a while ago with something known as the Mozart effect, the idea that listening to Mozart could make babies cleverer. But actually when the more robust studies were done, this wasn't really found to bear out. It was actually more of a correlational effect rather than something that actually was causal. But that's not to say that the arts don't have really profound effects on our cognition. Like singing to young babies, for example, helps with language developments, and engaging in the arts as we get older helps with so many aspects of our neural processing. It actually helps to preserve cognition, helping people to build their cognitive resilience as they get older.
Daisy, Philip mentioned before the work that he'd done in a hospital setting as well, and that different people responded to different kinds of music. We're talking about audio art specifically. When you're talking about the sorts of benefits that people can get from art, what kind of art does it, is it based on what someone's preference is, or are there some types of art that are more powerful than others?
Preference is really important here because art isn't just about what we experience, but it's about our own memories and our own personalities and experiences that moderate how we interpret that art's experience. That said, there are some ingredients, I guess, of arts activities that we know can be, for example, relaxing. So we heard in that beautiful soundscape just then, that sense of that low pitch and some of the noises and also some of the slow beats that were coming through. One of the things we know with music is that when we're listening to regular slow beats, we actually tend to synchronize with them. It's a process called entrainment. And that synchronization happens in our brains, in our breathing, in our heart rate, and actually leads to an overall physiological relaxation response. And that's just one of the examples of the specific ingredients or components that we know we can manipulate to change how people are influenced by the arts.
So what I'm hearing is art can be really powerful. It's something that we sometimes fund really well. Philip, you've had been the beneficiary of a couple of different fellowships, but some parts of the arts aren't funded well. Philip, do we need to be better at funding the arts?
Yes.
What a shock that an artist would say that.
I would argue, yeah, on behalf of my community, clearly, and sector, that more money is a good thing. But I've never, yeah, clearly I've enjoyed a lot of benefits in terms of fellowships and grants and other research opportunities as well. But money's never been the principal driver of the things that I've done. It's curiosity, and it's about community, and it's about expressing, from my perspective, underrepresented communities and stories and voices, regions, things of that nature. So, yes, you need money to kind of help fund some of that. But I've, you know, from the get-go, I've worked. And so I've always used my art during my downtime, spare time, as a way of expressing myself, and I've worked to generate the income to support the art. And I think that's where some people become resentful, in the fact that they expect art to fund their lifestyle or their artistic practice. And that's great if you're a commercial artist and you're able to sell your work, but 95% of us make unsellable art. And so how do we sustain that? So rather than becoming disenchanted by it all, it's about finding other ways of producing and finding agency in how you go about it and how you build audiences. And as Daisy's also spoken to, the satisfaction that you have of producing something that's you, that's your experience of the world, and it's your contribution to society in ways that no one else could articulate that.
Well, Philip, Daisy, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Our pleasure.
Professor Daisy Fancourt researches psychobiology and epidemiology at the University College London. She's also the director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Centre on Arts and Health, and the author of Art Cure, The Science of How the Arts Save Lives. Professor Philip Simatsis is a sound artist, researcher and curator with RMIT University and a three-time Australian Antarctic Arts Fellow. And I have loved reading your text this morning on the art that has saved your life. One person says, Nick Cave's music and artistic expression around the loss of his son Arthur helped me through a pregnancy loss. I will forever be grateful for his music and musics. They are a balm and a tonic and create a feeling of connection in isolation. Another says, to produce anything is in itself artistic. Humans were always primed to create, and that in itself is an artistic impulse. It's only when humans were forced to produce through industrial measures that our collective impulse to create art has waned. Well, one little promo before I move on. If you liked Philip's soundscapes, you can obviously look him up. But my colleague Anne Jones, who you might know from What the Duck, has created beautiful long soundscapes of the Australian bush. It's called Nature Track. Perfect for falling asleep too. You just search Nature Track in ABC Listen to check those out. But up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, what are your house rules when it comes to AI? Or do you feel like it's just moving so fast you can't keep up? Millennials were meant to be the digital native generation, the ones who understood the online world intuitively. Like, you grow up at the same time as a technology, you must be able to speak it fluently. Well, I can only speak for myself here, but as a millennial, artificial intelligence is still a bit of a black box to me. It's not that I think it's innately evil or anything, it's just the fact that the way we interact with digital spheres has changed so dramatically since I first logged on that a concept like AI literacy feels hard to define, let alone achieve. And if we don't understand it, how are we going to equip our kids to manage this brave new world that we're entering? With me is Lucy Pangrazio, an associate professor at Deakin University and chief investigator at the Centre for the Digital Child. Lucy, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks, Tegan. Great to be here.
So you've written about this concept of AI literacy. What do you even mean by that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And actually, the article is really trying to get to that very question, because traditionally literacy is thought of as this ability to read and write, and includes decoding and comprehending and constructing texts. And when we're thinking about texts, they're normally texts composed of alphanumeric letters, like books and movies and advertisements even. So when it comes to AI, our first question might be, what is even the text that we're trying to understand here? Is it the algorithm? Is it large language models or the data sets that it's composed of? So what are we trying to kind of decode and get our head around? And what I'm finding is that when we're talking about AI literacy, it's actually just learning how to use it. So learning to kind of embrace its power, rather than really thinking about, you know, are we using it critically? Are we using it ethically? And in many ways, this kind of gets reduced to this idea of being critical as being able to detect whether it's hallucinating or not.
Another part of this is, A, it's moving really fast, and B, the tech companies who own this data or own this technology don't want us to know how it works, because that's where their income stream is.
Yes, yeah, that's right. I think, you know, I mean, there's secrecy by design, really, like, and that's for a whole range of kind of proprietorial reasons. So I guess my question is literacy the right response to AI, when we really should be looking at, you know, other responses like regulation or sovereignty that will sit alongside the literacy's response, because we can't expect the individual on their own to be able to, really speak back to these big tech companies.
I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Lucy Pangrazio, Associate Professor at Deakin University, Chief Investigator at the Centre for the Digital Child, about AI literacy and what AI literacy means for us, how we achieve it, and whether that's even the right sort of way to be looking at things. I'm asking you what the AI house rules are at your place. One person's texted in on 0418 226 576 saying, my AI house rules, no use of AI in any private space, no bedrooms, etc., only within the family room setting where screens are open and visible to all of us in the house, younger siblings and parents, and only approved apps like AI art creation. Really, interesting. And another says, millennials are digital natives, but not AI native. That's the next generation. Well, here's hoping. And on the idea of educating the next generation on AI, I've got Natasha Banks here, the founder of Day of AI Australia, a free program that works with schools to build AI literacy. Natasha, when you're going into schools with this program, what's the base level of understanding you're seeing when you walk in?
Lovely to be here. Thanks so much. And Lucy, great paper. So our program is, we do call it an AI literacy program. And because we cover from K to 12 and we work with both government schools, state schools and independent schools, there really is a very, very broad range of knowledge, skills, abilities and confidence around AI. And I think it's a important thing to note that not everyone is coming from the same starting point. A lot of kids have a really strong digital literacy program in their schools, whereas other schools may not have, you know, an amazing digital technologies lead that's been able to implement that. So not everyone is coming from the same starting point. Some schools, we go in and have these very nuanced conversations with students about how AI is impacting their learning and, you know, setting up a policy within the school to ensure that everyone is having equitable access, all of those sorts of things. But it's a very, very mixed bag, Tegan.
When it's so mixed, how do you start when there might be differing levels of literacy in a given room?
Yeah, I think what we do with our program is we say it's a foundational AI literacy program. So when Lucy's talking about, you know, being good at prompting or, you know, being an effective user of their technology, that's not what our program is at all. It really is about providing what AI is, being able to identify when the technology is being used because it's becoming so ubiquitous. It's, you know, in our search results now, it's in social media algorithms. So that foundational idea around what it is and how it works, talking about what a large language model is, the fact that all of the information has basically been scraped from the internet, talking about ethical and responsible use. So really digging into those things around if, you know, large language models are built off the internet and things like Reddit, whose perspectives might be slightly overweighted in that, whose perspectives might be missing. You mentioned at the top of the segment around the black box of AI, this idea that we don't actually understand how it truly works. So how can anyone actually understand or be critical users of it if there is this kind of the transparency piece, talking about accountability. But we do encourage students to get hands-on with it. We do, in all of our lessons, have hands-on activities or gamified experiences so that they can see, you know, how it works. Really digging into those core concepts that we aim to develop those critical thinking skills, ethical reasoning, and those kind of creative collaboration, because it is an amazing tool. It is going to be part of the world that they live in. Increasingly, jobs are really looking for those skills with future workers. So we want to help students prepare for that future and the reality of the world that they're living in.
Lucy, listening to Natasha and the work she's doing, what's going through your mind?
Yes, look, I think Natasha's approach is great, and I think that's certainly part of the piece is around, you know, the hands-on experience, understanding, you know, what is large language models are, the way things are weighted. And I think that needs to sit alongside other responses to AI because, you know, it is such a big, powerful technology. And as Natasha has said, it's already embedded in many of the things that we're already using. So I guess my question is also around, you know, whether literacies is the right response in all situations, given that we often don't have a choice about whether we're using it or not. So if you take Microsoft, you know, Copilot, for example, which many workplaces now have as their kind of platform, it's already embedded in there. And whether you like it or not, you're being forced to use it. So it makes it very hard to evaluate, you know, this technology. So I guess my question is just around whether this is literacies that we're actually talking about or something different. So I definitely agree we need an educative response, but I'm just not sure that literacies is the kind of, you know, something that goes back to the 16th century is really the response that we need in this era.
Texted saying, yes, actively resist using AI. Call out those using AI without declaring use. So Lucy, if literacy is only part of the response. What does the rest of the response look like?
Yeah, I think there's some interesting initiatives going on around the world and in Europe as well, in particular. But I think obviously regulation is a really important part of this. So rather than responsibilizing the user to kind of be using it critically and ethically, we need to be pushing back and thinking about our rights. So, you know, is our privacy being jeopardized? Are we using AI that is, you know, created and made in safe and ethical ways? Is it free from bias and discrimination? And that's really a question for tech companies. That's not something that an individual user can do very much about. There's also been some movement around sovereignty, so AI sovereignty, where the focus is on countries, institutions and organisations developing their own AI and independently controlling their own data infrastructures. And that might sit really nicely alongside a kind of more, you know, literacies, if you like, if that's what we want to call it, approach, where people learn what it is, how it's used, but also maintain control over it.
So, Tash, if there is something that you would like anyone to take away from the classes that you teach with kids in school, what would it be?
You started the segment with a question about what is, you know, families' tech use. I think it's a really good conversation for parents to have with their kids and for parents to be, well, and adults, you don't have to have kids, just to be as responsible around educating yourself around the tools that probably, as Lucy says, you're using at work every day because they're probably embedded in the systems that you're using. Questioning, like having a look at the terms and conditions, understanding whether the data that you're putting in is going in to retrain the model, you know, is it in terms of those privacy considerations. So definitely have those conversations. There's a lot of really great resources to have those discussions with kids, the eSafety Commissioner. We have a tool that's available on our website, dayofaiaustralia.com, but there's a lot of tools to help have those conversations and to set those really good kind of tech practices that encourage critical thinking, safe use, and ethical and responsible understanding of this pretty powerful technology.
Lucy and Natasha, thank you both so much. Lucy Pangrazio is an associate professor at Deakin University, chief investigator at the Centre for the Digital Child. And Natasha Banks is the founder of Day of AI Australia, a free program that works with schools to build AI literacy. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. University has always been about so much more than just the coursework, but as students return to their studies this week, campus is not the hive of social activity it once was. Not as many wild fresher shenanigans, uni bars are few and far between, most lectures are pre-recorded and available online. We had a great conversation earlier on how campus culture has changed. Andrew Martin, Professor of Educational Psychology at University of New South Wales, weighed in on how we learn differently in person compared to online.
If we look at how students learn, I mean, the aim of learning is to be able to, at the end of it, you've stored something away in long-term memory and you can retrieve it, you know, when you need to at a later point. That's what learning is. And, you know, an in-person, real-time lecture, you know, enables you to do that. It's typically linear. The lecturer is presenting one thing at a time. You're there with fewer distractions than if you're online. Online, there are many screens. There's a chat bar. You're probably, you know, surfing that net or doing something as well. And then, of course, you can do that in the lecture theatre as well, but it's harder. And so, all of that means that you know, you're pretty much on track and on target, and you optimize your capacity to basically process the information that is being presented to you because you've dedicated that space and time to do that. Online makes that harder. There are a lot of distractions. It jams what we call working memory. It does affect learning. And so if you're going to be learning online, you need an enormous amount of self-discipline and self-regulation to be focused just on that.
That, of course, is Professor Andrew Martin from UNSW talking to me earlier in the show. I do recommend going back and listening to that full conversation. It was really fun. You can find it by searching Life Matters on ABC Listen. Thank you so much for your text this morning on the power of art to save lives. One says, I smile and get choked up as I think about my first 2 years on campus at uni around 2006 to 2008. new experiences, new friends, crazy social groups. I even met my wife in second year while on exchange in South Korea. I wonder how many going through uni online will have such fond memories. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the death of the letter. The boss of Australia Post has said it will eventually abandon its letter service. So what does a post-post world look like? I'd love to know about the handwritten letter or letters that you treasure. Plus, soft skills are even more important for us human workers as AI takes over more tasks, as we've been speaking about today. But so-called soft skills, empathy and compassion, are some of the hardest things to get right. Do we take them seriously enough? That's tomorrow on Life Matters. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.